Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. A few years ago, I started having this weird and intense pain in my arms and hands. It was so bad, it woke me up at night. Eventually, I went to see my doctor, and we went down a couple of rabbit holes, you know, blood tests, a visit to an infectious disease doctor who said, nope, not it. The pain took up a lot of space in my head. At night, in bed, I Googled inexplicable pain in arms until I fell asleep. My doctor ordered some more blood tests, and based on those, she thought I might have lupus. She told me to go see a rheumatologist. It took a couple of weeks to even get an appointment with one, and when I got there, I had to go through this very long intake process with a resident, a young doctor. Her voice was very quiet. I could barely hear her. She asked me a million whispered questions. Have you had hair loss?
Do you have a rash on your cheeks for more than a month?
Do your fingers get numb?
Do you break out after you've been in the sun?
Do your joints swell up?
Is it painful to take a deep breath? Have you ever had a seizure?
It went on and on. Finally, the rheumatologist came in. He took a quick look at me, and this is what I remember. He said basically, okay, can you touch your toes? I said, sure. I bent down, I touched my toes, and he said, look, you don't have lupus. He said, I see lots of women just like you. Their doctors don't know where to send them, so they send them here. He wasn't being mean, just honest, and he looked over my chart again and assured me it's not lupus. I said, well, what do you think is causing this pain? And he said something like, I don't know, it could be a million things, but it's nothing I can help you with. The pain was still there, and just as bad as ever. Eventually, I found yet another doctor who realized that I had a hormonal imbalance and also sleep apnea. Once those things were addressed, my pain got better. I slept much more deeply. Everything eased up. This entire chase took about 9 months, and at times it felt so frustrating and even a little crazy to try to keep pushing for some kind of answer. This is something a lot of people go through with far worse health issues, feeling like a detective on a search for answers in their own medical mystery. They have to take charge of their treatment and keep pressing for answers. On today's episode, we're going to hear stories about getting the care you think you need, why it can be hard for patients and also doctors. Our first story comes from Mimi Hayes, a comedian and writer. She was in her early 20s when she started having some very strange symptoms, and everywhere she turned, she was told it was anxiety, exhaustion, or really nothing. She was ready to give up, but her mom wasn't having it.
I went on a blind date. OkCupid, I think. He was your typical finance bro. Crew cut, one of those fleece vests. We ordered appetizers. My head was throbbing like crazy. All I could think about was getting through this and getting home. My mom picked me up after because my car had broken down that week. Mom and I are kind of partners in crime. Speaking of crime, we watch a lot of Forensic Files late at night together. She falls asleep at the sound of incriminating evidence.
Well, she had been out on a date, but she was so disheveled. She was tired, she was cranky, she didn't look good at all, and she had a horrible, horrible headache. I mean, like, bad, bad headache. And so I remember taking her home, you know, I think we gave her some aspirin, but she was sick.
I was 22 at the time, living with my mom in Aurora, Colorado, just about to start my first job as a high school teacher.
I just kind of brushed it off as, oh, well, she's doing it again. She's just not taking care of herself, and she's going in 5,000 directions, which has been an issue with Mimi since day one.
But then things got worse. About a week in, I got sick on my way to school and had to pull over on the side of the road to throw up. Mom took me to urgent care that day.
They said, oh, it's vertigo. And so they said, just get some over-the-counter
Dramamine. You know, that stuff you take when you're carsick. Well, I took that, and that's not helping. Next up is my primary care doctor. Mom came along to that appointment, too. There they said that it had something to do with fluid in my ears. I needed to see a specialist. Mom got crafty.
Because that's what the doctor's saying, is the ears. And we can't get into a specialist, so I'm going to fix this myself.
Here we go. So Mom decided to get me on the family inversion table and had my older sister flip me upside down for about 10 minutes to get the supposedly blocked fluid out of my ears.
It was the weirdest feeling. It was like all of my guts felt like they were like in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Like not in a normal way.
I got so terribly sick after that first flip, I can't even tell you. I couldn't move my head without puking. My sister rushed me to the nearest ER. I felt like my stomach was in my head. They didn't have any answers. As far as they were concerned, I was dehydrated. A nurse missed my vein, an entire bag of IV fluid leaked into my lap, and she accused me of pissing myself.
But then in comes this other doctor, and he was a neurologist. And he literally did this, you know, follow my fingers things. And you're saying, there's two fingers. And then he walked away, and that was all he did.
He had only been holding up one finger. Apparently that neurologist didn't see my double vision as too concerning. I went home in paper pants. And the next morning, Mom made me call my doctor and tell her what had happened. But I kept getting a nurse, and she told me just to get some rest.
You just need to rest, is what she said. And then I called you back.
In tears, yeah.
And I said, well, I guess this is my life now. I guess I just need to sleep this off.
At this point, she snapped.
I came home and
It felt like within seconds you burst through the door.
Yeah, I literally did. I was like, I'm out of here. And
Mom is not the type to roll over. Picture Queen Khaleesi in Game of Thrones when she goes all fire and brimstone. She left work and took me back to the ER. This time at a different hospital.
I just remember just a very quick, brief triage questions about, you know, am I bleeding? Like, it just felt like I didn't deserve to be there because right. I didn't know what was going on.
Well,
and
I honestly
kind of thought you were overreacting. Oh, God, she's going to cause a scene.
I did cause a scene.
And you did.
I immediately informed them that I'd already talked to my attorney and that we weren't leaving until they figured out what was wrong with you. And so I was lying through my teeth.
There's no attorney.
Oh, of course not. But that's how frustrated I was.
Finally, we got in to see a nurse. And she did that same neuro test, holding her finger in front of my eyes. Except she was doing it wrong. She wasn't moving her finger.
And at that point, I just lost my cookies. And I literally leaped out of my chair and I said, no. And I had seen the neurologist the day before do the neurological exam with his finger because I just seen that. And so I go, no. And also I'm a psychologist. I knew a little bit about brains. So I go, no, it's like this. And I did the exam and she goes right there. I go, it's over here, you know. And so I did the exam. I literally pushed the lady out of the way. That's how crazy I was.
When my mom did the neuro test, my eyes were all over the place, wiggling and not able to follow her finger. They finally agreed to give me an MRI. The scan revealed a circular blood spot on my brain, a ruptured clump of cells called a cavernous angioma, sitting in my cerebellum on the right side. They said the words hemorrhagic stroke for the first time. And then the nurse quickly left the room. And I had a panic attack. Was I about to die right now on this little metal table? How long can you live with a bleed in your brain anyway? My bleed was contained inside that clump of cells, at least for the time being. The clump had perhaps been there since I was born, and now it had filled with blood. They sent me home with some steroids and told me to check in a few weeks. It didn't get better. I got worse. The brain bleed continued to grow. Eventually, I was unable to walk or see straight. I needed brain surgery to remove the bleeding clump of cells, and then months of rehab to relearn how to walk, talk, and do third grade math problems. My mom saved my life that day. But what if she hadn't been there? What if they didn't catch it at all? I could have ended up permanently disabled. Or worse, I could have died. I couldn't help but feel angry. How come everybody but my mom dismissed my symptoms?
I think there's no doubt from what you've said that what you experienced would probably be classified as a medical mistake or a medical error. It's the kind of error we would call a diagnostic delay.
This is Matthew Winia over at the University of Colorado. He's the director of the Center of Bioethics and Humanities down at the Anschutz Medical Campus in my hometown of Aurora. He studies breakdowns in the healthcare system.
If you are dealing with a young person, the odds that they're going to be having a stroke compared to, you know, a 70 or an 80-year-old are really, really small. They're not zero, though, as you know, but they are quite small. And so the barrier to jumping straight to, you know, a CT scan or an MRI scan is considerably higher. It's mm-hmm. all sort of a balancing act of, you know, at what point do you pull the trigger and say, okay, we ought to get the MRI scan, knowing that 9 or 90 or 99 times out of 100, it's not going to show anything useful. And a few times out of 100, it might actually end up being harmful.
There's some interesting psychology on this, too. Matt called it premature closure, or the process of finding evidence to support your opinions and downgrading anything that might go against that.
You know, this is a young woman. She probably has a migraine. Okay, so now I'm just looking for things that confirm it's a migraine, and anything that disconfirms that, I'm going to downplay or downgrade in my mind.
And while approximately 795,000 people in the U.S. have strokes each year, 15% of those young adults and adolescents, they often don't have any of the typical symptoms.
So something that's been quite interesting to me is...
I talked about that with Amelia Baim, a neuroepidemiologist at Columbia University.
About 35% of people between the age of 18 and 35 who were admitted for a stroke did not have any stroke risk factors.
Wait, how much percent?
About 35%.
These are all the risk factors you usually have before you have a stroke.
Hypertension, diabetes, atrial fibrillation, obesity, and smoking.
Doctors use the acronym BFAST to identify traditional stroke symptoms. I only had the B, which is balance, and E, which is eyes. And we also know very little about the outcomes for young stroke victims, how they recover, and what their quality of life is. I also talked to Laura Stein, professor of emergency medicine at Mount Sinai.
You know, I can give you statistics about rates of recurrent stroke or rates of heart attack in young people who are hospitalized for these conditions, but I can't tell you anything about their self-report of quality of life after stroke, about really meaningful things like fatigue, depression, anxiety, ability to go back to every single thing they were doing. That's the kind of data that we really don't have, and that's the kind of stuff that's really meaningful to young people who have their entire lives to live with the experience that they've had.
I was really fortunate to have physical, occupational, and speech therapy right after my surgery. But I wanted to know, how were other survivors doing? And where were they? In an unlikely place, actually. Instagram. I had been posting pictures about my brain injury for Brain Injury Awareness Month. I was about 3 years post-stroke. I was living in New York City then, and fulfilling the typical starving artist stereotype as a stand-up comedian, a nanny, and like five other jobs I can't even remember. During March, I posted a picture of myself with noise-canceling headphones, because sound was bothering me on the New York City subways.
And you had your headphones on, and I just remember I, like right now, I broke down, and all I wanted to do was give you a hug. because I knew exactly what you were going through. I knew exactly what you were feeling.
This is Joe Borges. He's a podcaster and stroke survivor out in LA. In 2016, he was in a parking lot when he had the worst headache of his life. He is still sensitive to sounds like I am.
I reached out because I saw somebody who was like me, and I needed to connect with somebody like me because I really felt alone. And it was the most isolating time in my life. And I had no idea, because brain injury, that you had this impact on my life, Mimi. This is awesome. Thank you, you tiny, amazing human being.
I love you, Joe.
It changed my life. It genuinely changed my life.
Joe and I have never met in person, yet we've laughed together, cried together, and given each other our most vulnerable selves. What started as a way to find people like him has led Joe on a mission to support and uplift survivors on their roads to recovery. Joe sends upwards of 30 messages a day to survivors on social media to give them hope, ask them about their struggles, and connect them with other survivors in their cities.
We're bonded by tragedy, but we've become like family by choice. You know, I want everybody to feel this because it's necessary. It's necessary to grow and move forward in recovery. You know, like even people who are 7, 8, 9, 10, 15, 20 years out, they still have room to grow in recovery. You know what I mean? This is where the focus should be.
Joe and I are lucky. We've recovered in ways that many don't. My recovery isn't over just yet. Maybe never will be. It's been 6 years and I still struggle with fatigue, brain fog, and double vision in the mornings. But it feels like a small price to pay. Maybe I'll even get to meet my best friend Joe in person someday.
And I can't believe I haven't met you. It's like that show Love is Blind.
Oh my God, you know what's hilarious? I'm actually a 5'3" Asian woman. This is what's crazy.
That was comedian Mimi Hayes telling us the story of having a brain hemorrhage at a young age. I wanted to drill down a bit more on something that Mimi got into in her story. She felt like everywhere she went, healthcare professionals dismissed her symptoms. But then the medical ethicist she talked to said, look, doctors have to balance what is a likely cause or a very unlikely cause of a symptom. And that's something I talked about with Paul Offit.
As a medical student from day one, you are taught that if you hear hoofbeats, that you should think horses because horses are far more common than zebras. You're taught not to think instantly of zebras.
Paul is an infectious disease specialist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Working there changes the horse-to-zebra ratio significantly. His patients have usually already been seen by other physicians, and they have something serious going on. So in Paul's life, zebras are common.
So when we, for example, see someone with a sore throat, we'll think about an unusual disorder called Lemierre's disease, which is a thrombophlebitis, which is to say an infection of a vein in the neck that ultimately causes a bacteria to invade the lung. And it's a very unusual disease, and we see it, frankly, all the time.
I asked Paul how he makes a diagnosis, balancing common causes, rare diseases, all of the options before him.
You have to keep tearing it down to what are the hard findings that you have. You know that X is true. You know that Y is true. Given that, how do you put that together? You keep working from there. It's there. There'll be an answer there. Just have to keep working.
And what's your equivalent of me going online and Googling my symptoms? So if you're stuck and you have a case and you need to get to the next level, where do you go? Do you reach out to your colleagues? Do you have a network?
Our equivalent of Googling online is Googling online, which is what we do. We actually just go. In fact, Google is a great resource to do this. You just look for case reports that are similar to see whether or not this has been reported before.
Do colleagues reach out to each other?
All the time. And so there are experts in, for example, tuberculosis or experts in fungal disease or experts in vaccines. So whenever we have an issue, they can often help us.
Is it a little bit like being a detective sometimes?
It's often like being a detective, and that's the fun part of it. It's more fun when you actually figure it out, but, you know, it's a little less fun when it takes you too long to figure it out. You know, you have this set of signs and symptoms, and you're trying, and you come up with what you think it is. This is what you think it is. And so you sort of move forward with those tests, and then you see whether or not you're right.
I'm thinking nowadays patients probably are asking for more tests because they have perhaps heard of tests, or we are learning more online. How is that affecting medicine in what you see and what you hear from your colleagues?
My sense is people don't have to ask for more tests. We seem to be perfectly willing to do a lot of diagnostic procedures and tests, arguably too much so. I mean, you could argue that in a better system, you would formulate a differential diagnosis from what you think is most likely to what is least likely, and then start with most likely and work your way down. What we tend to do is just include all of those diagnoses in our initial round of tests because we don't want to miss anything for any length of time. That's a far more expensive way to do things.
But how do you do that most likely and least likely when there's always a chance that it is the least likely and then you miss something? So how do you learn that balance?
You know, what are the signs and symptoms of that patient, rating them in the following way. The most important thing is the history that the person gives you. The second most important thing is the physical exam. And the least important thing generally are the laboratory tests.
And I guess living with those decisions is something that as a physician you just have to learn when the decision was not the right one.
Right. I think the most difficult part about being a doctor, frankly, is the fact that, one, we don't know everything. Two, there's always some level of uncertainty. I mean, you know, there's layers that protect you. I mean, the intern has seen the patient. The senior resident has seen the patient. The fellow in infectious disease has seen the patient. You've seen the patient. So there's a lot of layers there, and you do testing to try and figure this out. But the fact of the matter is there's always uncertainty in what you do, and you always know to some extent that you may be missing something. And that's difficult. It's difficult to live with uncertainty, not just for the doctor, but also obviously for the patient. You'd like to think that we're all bones from Star Trek, you know, where you can just have that magic machine that scans up and down and says, this is what you have. It just doesn't work that way.
Paul Offit heads the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Most recently, we talked to him for our episode on the coronavirus vaccines. We're talking about navigating the medical system, pushing for the right diagnosis, the right treatment. In the U.S., Black women are much more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women. Our next story is about a woman who wanted to play a role in changing that. What got her onto this path was a great experience as a patient, and she wanted to make sure that the same kind of experience would be available to more Black women. From Nashville, Damon Mitchell has this story on how a Tennessee doula program got started.
Krista Mejia Green never intended to become a birth worker. She wanted to be a speech pathologist, and she definitely never imagined herself as a mom with two kids.
I became a mother because of pride and hypocrisy, and I did not want to be a hypocrite because everyone in my family knew I was pro-life.
Kristen found out she was pregnant with her oldest son the day she applied to grad school. She says she was on birth control and had done everything to make sure this wouldn't happen.
Here I am, I pee on the stick, I see two lines, and the first thing in my mind is like, oh no, I can't do this. And then the second thing in my mind is, well, I can't do that either because everybody knows I'm against that.
She had an awful pregnancy. It was uncomfortable. She could smell everything, fighting through bouts of morning sickness. She regretted nearly every moment of it until she didn't.
I had an amazing, exhilarating, empowering birth. So that was where the switch got flipped.
Kristen's delivery was perfect. She had a great birthing team. Breastfeeding and all the new things that might trouble new moms just worked for her. Still, Kristen knew that her experience was something many other Black women did not have, and she wanted to make sure more Black women had access to supportive care. That's what motivated her to become a doula. Kristen finished her doula training in 2016 and started working with clients. After, she had an experience she was not ready for, the death of an infant.
And that was the moment that I realized that I had not been trained on that properly. I didn't know what to do.
It began after she started working with a Black mom at a Tennessee health clinic, just days before a planned C-section. Her baby was expected to die after his birth because of medical defects. And the doctor, who was white, kept reminding them of that.
She just kept saying, and I finally was like, okay, we know.
The baby died 3 days after being born. Kristen, who was struggling to hold back her own tears, was there to comfort the mom.
We saw this beam of light shine into the window, right on his face, and she felt him, and I could see it, and she felt him take his last breath.
Kristen felt like the hospital staff didn't treat the mom with the compassion she needed. At times, it felt like the staff was talking down to the mom and not respecting her wishes. Kristen realized that the white lead doula training she graduated from hadn't prepared her to support and fight for the black women she wanted to work with. There was a disconnect between the different needs of white moms versus pregnant black women, like how to have conversations about raising black children and speaking up against racial biases in the hospital room. This experience led Kristen to start her own birthing program. She started a nonprofit called Homeland Heartbirth and Wellness Collective, which teaches workshops led by black women for black women. The ultimate goal is to eliminate the racial disparities in infant and maternal mortality rates. She says it's a place where black women can find companionship, others to relate to, and be free without having to code switch. I went to the group's very first two-day workshop with more than a dozen women. Kristen says it's one of the first in Nashville, Tennessee, to train black women to become companions and advocates for other black women during and after childbirth. At times, that means walking a mom through postpartum breastfeeding techniques.
You see all these veins pulling down here, close to the nipple? The massage helps you relax. Sure, this is a little uncomfortable, but massaging is helping me be a little bit more comfortable.
Other times, it's helping clients relieve pain in the birthing room. This can be done by transferring a pregnant mom from a hospital bed to an exercise ball.
The ball will give her the proper width between her body and the bed, okay? So she's able to still pull, stretch those ligaments out a little bit.
Kristen's program attracted women like Nicole Ward. She's a social worker in a Tennessee psychiatric hospital. Nicole had a miscarriage in 2017 after emergency room doctors ignored her sharp stomach pains. Outside of close family, she's never talked about the experience. She didn't even tell her husband when it first happened.
And the pain would not go away. It was like had me up all night. So I went back to the emergency room and they looked. They were like, we think we see some things in your fallopian tube. It might be ectopic pregnancy. Not really sure. Just take some Tylenol. You'll be fine.
She felt like her pain was not taken seriously. That's when Nicole went to another hospital, hoping for a better response. What the doctor said was shocking.
And he goes, well, no matter how many hospitals you go to, you're still going to have a miscarriage. Your baby's dying.
Nicole was speechless. She felt powerless. The doctor was harsh and dismissive. But Nicole figured that maybe that's just how pregnant black women were treated.
As black women, we are seen as like those warriors, those strong people all the time. So it only makes sense because I can't imagine him speaking with a white woman like that.
There was a study that came out in 2016 where medical students and residents were asked and they verbalized that black people have tougher skin and that they deal with pain a lot better than other races.
That's Stephanie Devane Johnson. She's a midwife and Tennessee nursing professor. She says racism is one of the many factors contributing to black maternal mortality rates. Other problems are stress and being misdiagnosed during pregnancy. Stephanie says the myth of tougher skin can be traced back to the 19th century in physician James Marion Sims. He's considered the father of gynecology. James became infamous for conducting medical experiments on enslaved black women without anesthesia. These same old pain biases still exist today. Stephanie says it's a result of racist medical history not being taught or discussed in schools.
We've had the conversation with some of my students, and they're just like, well, I don't see color.
Stephanie says that isn't a good thing. She says oftentimes it means budding medical professionals don't understand the history that black people have come from. So Kristen says black women shouldn't have to squeeze into spaces that weren't meant for them.
We just need to get to a place where we are confident and comfortable in doing things for ourselves.
She says if there were more Black doulas to advocate for Black women, the racial disparities in infant and maternal care would be easier to eliminate. For The Post, I'm Damon Mitchell.
Damon is a reporter at WPLN in Nashville, Tennessee. Coming up, dealing with symptoms that medical professionals say are not real.
And I would tell them, you know, I'm going through topical steroid withdrawal, and they would just look at me like I was crazy. They just kind of said, no, this doesn't happen.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable, quality health care for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're hearing stories about navigating healthcare, people taking an active role in their treatment because they feel like they're not getting the care they need. Millions of Americans have a common skin condition called eczema. It's caused by inflammation. The skin gets red, dry, really itchy, and sometimes raw. If you show up at a doctor's office with eczema, chances are you'll go home with a tube of topical steroids to reduce that inflammation. They quickly calm down the symptoms, but some people say eventually those steroid creams can become a menace. Liz Tong has this story of a woman who felt like she had to stop using these creams, and the fallout was major.
Nina Iden was about 10 when she was first diagnosed with eczema.
I had a small rash under my armpit, and my mom took me to the doctor.
They told her it was atopic dermatitis. That's the most common form of eczema, and at first, it wasn't a big deal.
Like small little rashes, I would flare up a little bit, maybe like behind my knees, you know, where you would kind of sweat the most or in the creases of the elbows.
So Nina's doctor prescribed a steroid cream.
A higher potency hydrocortisone.
Topical steroids are pretty much the go-to treatment for eczema. They're part of a class called corticosteroids. Basically, these synthetic hormones that appear in everything from creams to asthma inhalers, all the way to powerful oral medications like prednisone. And the reason you find them in so many medications is they have this superpower, which is fighting inflammation. So quick explainer, inflammation is basically an immune response. The swelling and itching result when special proteins sound an alarm and a bunch of white blood cells rush over to fight off the threat. Steroids work by suppressing that response, which they do in a couple ways. First, they block the formation of those alarm proteins. Second, they constrict blood vessels, which reduces swelling and pain. And third, they tamp down the immune system, which in people with eczema has sort of this hair trigger reactiveness. So steroids aren't a cure, but they prevent the vicious cycle of itching and scratching, which is what really makes eczema a lot worse. The problem is steroids have side effects, which means you're only supposed to use them for a couple weeks at a time. The one you hear the most about is thinning of the skin, but there's also stretch marks or easy bruising. And with the stronger steroids, for instance, prednisone, you start getting into things like weight gain, puffiness, mood changes, which for a lot of people have gotten mixed up into this kind of general fear of steroids. It's something dermatologists have noticed a lot. They even have a name for it. Topical corticosteroid phobia.
They can be very, very afraid of steroids.
That's dermatologist Peter Leo. He's an eczema specialist in Chicago, and he says he's seen patients on both sides of the fence. On the one side, people who are so paranoid that they would rather suffer than even try steroids. And on the other, people who are scarily blasé about them.
Sometimes I've even seen patients who use a family member's prescription. They use somebody else's, Uncle Bob's cream.
In fact, studies show that patients are kind of terrible at following instructions for topical drugs. And that carelessness can extend to doctors, too. according to research, prescriptions of strong topical steroids have actually increased over the past 20 years. And Peter says a lot of doctors just aren't aware of the risks.
Okay, here's a big tub of, you know, a strong cortisone with 11 refills. Good luck.
Which brings us back to Nina Iden. As a kid, she says she used topical steroids pretty sparingly. But as she got older, the eczema spread. And her doctors started prescribing more and stronger steroids.
You know, I would use the steroids a little bit until it went away and then stop them. And then the eczema would spread to somewhere else. And then I would have to go back and get steroids again to clear that up.
Around her teen years, the flare-ups got more frequent and steadily worse. And then at the age of 17, things went downhill fast.
I lost all of my hair suddenly. I think that's when my life really took a turn.
Nina's doctors diagnosed her with alopecia, which, like eczema, is an autoimmune disease, which means the symptoms are caused by your immune system freaking out and attacking the body. So doctors prescribed Nina with two super serious drugs, an immunosuppressant that's actually used in cancer treatment, and oral prednisone, a powerful steroid that you take in pill form. Nina ended up getting her hair back, but she says after starting both drugs, her body went completely berserk. She started getting all these infections thanks to the drugs suppressing her immune system. She was diagnosed with anxiety and depression, and her eczema got worse than ever before.
Very out of control. I mean, it was starting to get red and burning and really hard to describe. It's like having acid poured on your skin.
Nina's doctors prescribed stronger and stronger steroids, but soon nothing was working. And Nina started having suicidal thoughts.
I just didn't see any light at the end of the tunnel because nobody had any idea what was going on. So, you know, in my mind at that time, it was like, well, if nobody knows what's going on, nobody can fix it. And I'm just going to have to live like this for the rest of my life.
Nina had lost all hope of figuring out what was going on with her body. But her dad had noticed something. It seemed like every time she was prescribed a new course of steroids, things followed a pattern. For a while, her skin would get better, but then she'd get worse, including her mental health. So he looked around on the internet, and he started finding these stories, blogs and YouTube videos with people describing a lot of the same things Nina was going through.
Crazy rashes on my face.
I usually have cuts all over.
It's red, burning, itching,
it's
eczema.
It's all red and blotchy, and it's kind of swollen and puffy.
Blistery, weepy.
What they all shared, a condition they were calling topical steroid addiction. So Nina's dad found a video of a dermatologist explaining it and sent it to Nina.
Topical corticosteroid
addicted people.
I just remember sitting in my room and just bawling my eyes out watching this video because I could relate to every single word that, you know, he was saying.
As it turned out, there was an entire online community based around topical steroid addiction. Blogs and websites, message boards with thousands of members. And they all said the same thing. The symptoms Nina had been having, the burning, the pain, the endless cycle of relief and relapse, were the result of her skin becoming addicted to topical steroids. And the only solution was quitting.
Cold turkey is the only way.
For Nina, it was a revelation.
You know, this is it. This is my light. You know, I had no idea at the time what I was getting myself into.
Nina knew from all the videos and websites that there would be side effects, what they called topical steroid withdrawal. But she couldn't have guessed how bad it would get.
I have never in my life experienced such excruciating pain. It was such pain to the point that I was screaming at the top of my lungs.
You can see the transformation in YouTube videos that Nina shot tracking her progress. The first month, she looks like someone with a head-to-toe sunburn. The next month, her hair falls out. By month six, she was covered in red splotches and open wounds.
Like very, very open, like somebody took a knife to them. That's how open they were.
During the worst of it, Nina says she couldn't do anything for herself. Her parents had to help her eat, help her dress, help her bathe. They would ease her into Epsom salt baths to prevent her cuts from getting infected. And then there was the ooze.
What happens is you ooze this lymph fluid that is actually part of the healing process, but it's very dehumanizing. It smells like your skin is just rotting away. Like our entire house smelled like this.
Now, I just want to pause for a second to acknowledge how crazy intense people say these symptoms are. Nina was an extreme case, but she definitely wasn't alone. In fact, descriptions like these have kind of become a rallying cry for people who say topical steroids can be really dangerous. But a lot of doctors don't see it that way.
It's very unlikely. Very, very unlikely.
That's Emma Gutman. She's one of the foremost eczema doctors in the world. We grabbed her while she was running through the airport, so apologies for the sound quality there. Anyway, she says that steroid addiction can happen with oral steroids like prednisone, but not so much with the weaker topicals that people use for eczema.
It's very unlikely unless very strong topical steroids are used and not according to guidelines.
But here's the thing. A lot of steroids aren't used according to guidelines or even prescribed according to guidelines. And more people seem to think that topical steroid addiction could be what's behind their skin problems. In 2015, that pushed the National Eczema Association to fund an investigation into topical steroid addiction and withdrawal. The study concluded that, yes, it is a thing that happens, but that it's also extremely rare, which means that a lot of doctors simply haven't heard of it. They think it's just someone with steroid phobia and a bad case of untreated eczema. That's the reaction Nina Iden heard from doctors when she said she was experiencing topical steroid withdrawal.
And I would tell them, I'm going through topical steroid withdrawal, and they would just look at me like I was crazy. They just kind of said, no, this doesn't happen, you know, and just kind of made me out to be like I was crazy.
Then, about a year into her withdrawal symptoms, Nina heard about a doctor who did believe in topical steroid addiction and withdrawal. His name? Peter Leo, the Chicago eczema specialist we heard from before. So she set up an appointment. Even now, he says Nina was the worst case he'd ever seen.
Yes. When she first came in, she was in pretty bad shape. I have a distinct memory of her being pretty close to erythrodermic, meaning kind of red all over. Lots and lots of impetiginization, the honey-colored crusting that is characteristic of Staph aureus infection, and lots of open oozing areas. I mean, she was pretty bad. So I knew, you know, already knew we were in for some serious stuff.
So Nina tells him about her history. Peter comes up with a treatment plan. Antibiotics for the infection, some topicals to soothe her skin, and an immunosuppressant to calm down the inflammation. But for Nina, just as important as the treatment plan was talking to a doctor who believed her.
Because, you know, now it's like, okay, so I'm not just, you know, crazy and doing this for nothing. This really is, you know, a real condition, and there is doctors who recognize it. So it was just pretty life-changing for me at that point.
It's been a slow process, but since then, Nina's skin has gotten a lot better. She still gets flare-ups, but she says she has a life again. She's working, going to school, and she's even started raising awareness about topical steroid addiction. As for Peter, he says he just wishes we had better options than steroids. Once that happens, this whole debate about whether topical steroid addiction is real or not won't matter anymore.
That story was reported by Liz Tung a couple of years ago, and since then, Nina says she's been doing better. She's still having some symptoms, but not nearly as severe. We're listening to stories about people who decided they had to play a more active role in their own healthcare, asking for specific treatments, a different approach, another test. For years, Netta Freja didn't take penicillin because when she was 13, she had a strange reaction.
I just remember being in my house and looking down on my legs, and they were itchy, and I had red hives all over them. And then from then on, I had a penicillin allergy in my medical chart. It just followed me everywhere I went.
About 30 million Americans have a documented penicillin allergy. And that means for them, most of the commonly prescribed antibiotics are off limits.
So in essence, the first line choice for most of our very common infections are not an option anymore. And so a person with a penicillin allergy often has to get second line antibiotics or even much broader spectrum, more powerful antibiotics that can have lots of very powerful and bad side effects.
Netta is a family medicine doctor now, and she saw this allergy note pop up on patients' charts often. Then her son was diagnosed with a penicillin allergy.
He had just like an ear infection and was on amoxicillin.
So, like, when I was 4,
I had a rash because I was taking penicillin.
Just a red, bumpy rash all over his body. And as in most cases, that's enough for the person to be told, okay, you're allergic to penicillin. And that went right on his chart, too.
But it turns out that
neither of us is allergic to penicillin.
How did you find that out?
So I think, as is so often the case in parenthood, I was more invested in my son's long-term well-being than I was in my own. And I thought, you know, I really don't want him to have this label on his chart. I don't want this world of potentially excellent medications to not be available to him for the rest of his life. And so I took him to see an allergist.
So I went to the doc, a nice woman, and she told me, like, what was going to happen.
And he went through a pretty simple skin testing procedure. They gave him one pill of amoxicillin afterwards when he passed the skin test, and he didn't have a reaction. So that label was totally taken off of his chart.
And then we could just leave. I was pretty much done. And while I was leaving, I was like really happy.
He is not allergic to penicillin.
Netta went through the same skin test and got the same result. And as she dug into more research, she found out this is really common.
We've actually learned in medicine that 95% of people who have a reported penicillin allergy are not allergic to penicillin.
She said that reaction she had as a teenager, that itchy rash, could have been from anything. Also, people sometimes outgrow these allergies. So what should physicians, and I'm thinking it's probably most likely primary care physicians who should know about this, what should physicians do differently?
I think one of the most important things is that when we see that penicillin allergy on a patient's chart, to ask more questions about it. We often treat that allergy tab as if it's written in stone, whereas other parts of the chart we're constantly updating and things are coming off and being added on. We should view that allergy tab with that same fluidity. So ask more questions. What actually happened? How old were you? In some cases, the reaction really is severe. They might have had their skin slough off of their body. That's serious, and that warrants more of like a closer investigation. But if it was that they had hives when they were 13, like me, then we could actually really think about sending them for testing and maybe taking that off of their chart.
And not having or being able, in quotes, to take those medications can have some pretty serious drawbacks, right?
Absolutely. There have actually been a number of studies that have shown that people with a reported penicillin allergy have a higher risk of really serious complications, like, for example, MRSA, that resistant staph infection, also C. diff or Clostridium difficile colitis, which can make a person incredibly sick. People with penicillin allergy have a higher risk of those kinds of infections. And so it's not a harmless thing to just kind of linger in your history for years and years.
And what's the reason for those bigger infections? Is that because they were treated with stronger antibiotics along the way?
That's exactly right, yes.
Netta Freja is an internal medicine physician and host of the Primary Care Reviews and Perspectives podcast. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.